Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues is our favorite, sort of our house doctor, Dr. Jennifer Michaels, medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been practiced for over 15 years. Let me tell you, folks, if there is one person who is a heroine, as far as I'm concerned, I guess that's a bad word, to me, it's Jennifer Michaels. She is known as the top of the top of the people who know about this stuff. Dr. Michaels, welcome back to Medical Monday.
Thank you so much. Good to see you, as always.
The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can also post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. And you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So, Dr. Michaels, everything we read is that this has really gotten to be an epidemic.
Yeah, that's the word, an epidemic, and we've never seen anything like this in the history of our country. There are some positives. We have Governor Baker, who just signed legislation to address the pill part of this addiction and also to make treatment more accessible.
Right.
So there's hope, but the barn doors are open, and the animals are out, and it's a little late, but we are doing something.
Now, as this occurs, is there more criminality? In other words, are there more people trying to hawk the stuff knowing they'll make money that way?
Yes, and I think, it's very lucrative. And I think we're a wealthy nation. We're a great mark.
Yeah.
We
I know that word.
Yeah, we do. And so I think that Mexico has capitalized on our market and other countries. And we're a bottomless pit for drugs.
We are. Anyway, we have a lot of calls. Do you mind, Jen? Let's go on the phone and start answering some calls. We'll go to Anita in Waterville. Okay, Anita, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Michaels. My question is about depression. I've been on 7 different antidepressants over the last 20 years, and the last one just didn't work at all. So I wondered, why don't they work, and what can I do?
Okay, good question, and I'm sorry they haven't worked better. Probably something to consider would be medication plus therapy. A very effective therapy is something called cognitive behavioral therapy. And go online and look for a cognitive behavioral therapist. That's something to think about. In addition, there are studies now showing that intense exercise has a wonderful antidepressant effect. And then the other thing to think about is if you are drinking or using other substances, they end up being depressants. So you want to live, a natural life without drugs or alcohol, and that may help too.
Thank you.
It's okay. Very interesting, Dr. Michaels, when you say that, because, I'm addicted to exercise, and I exercise for at least an hour every morning.
And you don't seem depressed at all.
Well, I am always wondering about, things. I mean, I think the world doesn't end well. So anyway, I really find myself feeling much better after I exercise.
And it's so true. And there are these studies looking at different groups, older people, middle-aged people. And if you add on regular exercise, it boosts the antidepressants. It acts as an antidepressant. So we all need to be exercising.
Do we know morning or afternoon? Do we have any sense of when to do this?
Well, I think any time is a good time.
Yeah.
I think we're more likely to exercise if we plan in the morning. Mm-hmm. See, I defy that. I'm a nighttime exercise person, and that's what I like to do. But morning, if you schedule morning, you're more likely to be successful.
And is it aerobic exercise you're talking about?
Yes, aerobic, cardiac.
Yeah.
and intense.
Interesting. I really like that. I believe in it. Anita, thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
You're living proof.
Okay, right. Okay. All right, let's go to our usual guest, Jim from Matamoros. Jim, what do you got?
Considering buprenorphine is only a partial mu blocker, how effective is it for severe pain?
Okay, so good question. I just want the people listening to know that buprenorphine is an opioid, meaning it binds to our brain opioid receptors. It's now most commonly used for people who have an opioid use disorder, people who are addicted to heroin or OxyContin. It does alleviate pain. It's not as effective as a pure activator of your brain. Something like methadone or oxycodone might be more effective. But the nice thing about buprenorphine is you will not overdose on it the way you could with those other medicines. And it's not as sedating and does not diminish your breathing the way methadone or other pure activators could. It's safer.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in are now 100%. 1-800-348-2551. You'll kick yourself later that you didn't ask the question you know you want to ask. And by the way, if you're suffering from an addiction, you're anonymous on the show. We'd love to hear from you. John from Albany. John, you're on.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Hey, John, could you get closer to the microphone on your telephone?
Is this better, Alan?
No, it's really not. We'd love to hear you. We can kind of make your sound out, but go ahead. Be loud.
I'll try to be as loud as I can.
Excellent.
Basically, I've been on Suboxone for almost a year now. I was addicted to heroin previously, and I'm getting to the point where I would like to get off of the Suboxone. I'm down to 1 milligram a day, and I was just curious if you had any good tips as to how to do it. I've heard a lot of horror stories, and it's kind of scary, you know?
Okay. Yes, it is scary for a lot of people. And I want to congratulate you on you being sober. That's great.
Thank you.
Some people decide to stay on Suboxone for the rest of their lives because it's much better than struggling with an active addiction to heroin.
And what is it again, doctor?
Suboxone is an opioid that's very long-acting.
Right.
It's the buprenorphine we just talked about, and it's a treatment it's a replacement. Instead of using heroin, you get on buprenorphine, also known as Suboxone, and it addresses craving and withdrawal.
Can you get addicted to it?
Well, you know, addiction is a funny word.
Yeah.
Because you can get physiologically dependent. You know, if you stop it suddenly, you'll feel withdrawal. But addiction means behavioral manifestations like taking more than you're supposed to or stealing money so you can buy it off the street. I would bet that John is not addicted, but probably physiologically dependent. Is that correct, John?
I would agree with that.
Yes.
Yes, ma'am. That's absolutely what I'm afraid of. It's like the whole habitual nature of it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, do you have any sort of tips as to, like, what I can do to make it an easy switch back to being a normal drug-free human being?
So I think that you're already very successful. I would suggest that you work with a doctor prescribing it and as slowly as possible lower your dose. I have patients who cut 1 milligram. They come in little strips. Cut 1 milligram
right.
into quarters, and you can, over the course of 3 or 4 months, lower by a quarter of a strip. The other thing to do is to create a new habit or new ritual. So if you take your medicine every morning, give yourself a little other treat every morning. For some people,
okay, that makes sense.
Yes, and I suggest this with cigarettes. You know, if you love your first cigarette in the morning, give yourself a non-nicotine treat instead, and then you will crave that treat. You'll crave something other than Suboxone.
And is it good to have a guide, somebody who can sort of get you through this?
Yes.
As opposed to doing it yourself?
And so, John, as I said, talk to your doctor and develop a plan. And studies have shown the longer you take to taper and the longer the period of stability on Suboxone, the more likely you are to be successful. This also is a good time to go to 12-step meetings.
Okay. Thank you very much, John. Appreciate your call. Okay. We're going to be taking a short break. We will be right back. Just seconds. So don't hang up if your name is Carolyn or Judy or whatever.
Thank you. support comes from Brattleboro Retreat, offering specialized trauma, mental health, and addiction treatment for police, fire, military, veterans, EMTs, and corrections personnel. BrattleboroRetreat.org. Nathan Letower Hospital, Gloversville, New York, community hospital for over 100 years, proudly introducing the gastroenterologist specialist of Letower, working to help put patients at ease with colonoscopies, NLH.org. George Heigl, Cowan's representative, specializing in evaluating, marketing, buying, and selling of jewelry, fine art, historic firearms, American Indian art, and more, 518-369-7994. Clipcentric Albany, a local video services division of Clipcentric, producing video advertisements for businesses throughout the capital region. For web, mobile, and TV, albany.clipcentric.com. And from Pine Cobble School, Williamstown, Massachusetts, where yoga is a weekly part of the curriculum for early childhood students. A good beginning never ends, pinecobble.org.
And we are back, thanks to Zachary. Okay, so anyway, we're with Dr. Jennifer Michaels, so the phones are loaded, but I did want to, well, there's one more phone free, but I did want to ask you a question, Dr. Michaels, if I may, and that is, you mentioned before that Governor Baker came out with a slew of legislation. Sounded reasonable to me. What did he get?
I think he got a lot. First of all, he's giving a lot of funding for more beds, treatment in Massachusetts, screening in the emergency rooms, more availability of the life-saving medication called Narcan. So when people overdose, we can rescue them with this medicine. Screening in schools. Also, physicians will need to check the prescription monitoring program when they prescribe opioids before they write that prescription.
Is that a big problem?
It's a huge problem. Yeah, that's how this problem started in 1995, that physicians started to overprescribe opioids. And they weren't alone in the game. You know, the pain became the fifth vital sign, and Purdue Pharma pushed the prescribing of OxyContin. But we were definitely part of it.
And so isn't there also a limitation on the prescribing of drugs in terms of how much you can give at a particular time? And all
yes,
that?
Yeah. Exactly. So right. The first time you write one of these prescriptions, it's a 7-day limit.
Yeah.
Also, patients can opt to partially fill their prescription. And if they get a 30-day supply after surgery, they can opt to just get a 7-day supply and leave the rest at the pharmacy.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, let's go to Carolyn in Red Hook. Okay, Carolyn, you're on line number 2, and it's your turn.
Hello, Dr. Michael and Dr. Shartok. I think it's Dr. Shartok. My question has to do with someone I know who I knew better many years ago but still have limited contact with, who has a cocaine smoking habit, and very, very bright individual, and is a functioning addict. I came across information. I've tried to offer him information over the years, let him pick a book out of the bookstore that he thought might be helpful, but he's very bright, he knows everything, and blah, blah. So anyway, I came across information that I thought might be helpful to him, but I have mixed feelings about whether I should drop it off or not, because I haven't had a lot of contact with him over the last year, you know, limited, and I'm wondering if there's any chance that he has cut back further or has stopped for the moment, that it might set him off.
Ah, okay. If you give him more information,
I'm on a place that seems to have good help.
You know, I think the general message when you're dealing with someone who's struggling with addiction is, I love you. I hate this disease and what it's doing to you.
Yep.
So if you can convey it in that way, I don't think it would set him off. I mean, I think what triggers people is drugs. And so you're talking about recovery, and I don't think that would trigger the person. But if you could convey that you're concerned and thinking about them, hoping they're well, if they're not well, this is something they might want to look into. That would not trigger the person.
Oh, thank you so much.
Okay, Carolyn,
Just additionally, can you tell me, in terms of the two drugs, marijuana and cocaine, I've heard that marijuana is worse for the brain and cocaine is worse for the heart. Do you have any information that would support that? Or,
well, you know, cocaine is more addictive than marijuana.
Yep.
And it also depends on the individual. In general, cocaine is more dangerous to the body.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
Bye. We'll go to Judy in Kerhonkson. Judy, you're on.
Okay. Hi, Dr. Michaels. I'm so glad to have this opportunity. I've had I'll call it an addiction, I'm not sure, but to Zolpidem. I don't sleep well. And in the middle of the night, I wake up and take about a third of a pill that's 10 ounces of 10 milligrams. And, somebody just came to the door. And that's really,
well, let him wait.
I'm confused. So I take a small dose, about a third of a pill, and it helps me get another 3 or so hours of sleep. And so I'm wondering, I don't know whether this is dangerous or what it is. Should I be concerned? Shall I go continue doing it? Shall I fight it? What?
And the drug, just for clarification, is Zolpidem?
It helps induce sleep.
Right, right. Jen, for all of us who wake up for a couple of hours in the middle of the night or an hour in the middle of the night, what is the right thing to get?
There's no perfect answer. You're talking about Ambien, so some people may be more familiar with that. I think as long as it doesn't escalate over time, you start out with a third and now you're taking a whole pill, as long as it doesn't impair your daytime functioning, you know, it may be working for you. But we want to rule out other issues. So, for example, sleep apnea is rampant. And if you're waking up because you have a breathing problem, that needs to be addressed instead of taking medicine. Yeah. Also, when people have depression, they wake up repeatedly, especially in the early morning hours. And an antidepressant may be more of what you need instead of a sleeping medicine.
No, I think I'm fine otherwise. I think this little bit of Ambien really does the job, and I'm aware that it could accelerate, and I'm very careful about that. This is comforting to know that.
Do you wake up feeling refreshed?
Oh, yeah, I feel good, yeah.
I think it's working.
Yeah. Okay.
That's good. We like that. Okay. Success.
Thanks, Dr. Judy. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks
Goodbye.
So much.
Bye-bye. Bye. We'll go to Chris in Altona. Okay, Chris, you're on. Your turn. Go ahead, Chris.
Dr. Michaels and Dr. Alan Chartok. My question is about MEO inhibitors. I have a family member who has resistant depression and has undergone therapy for a number of years and does not respond well to any of the traditional antidepressants. This individual is going to be taking the patch, using the patch. So I would like to know, and I can take my answer off the air, what MAO inhibitors are, what the medication, how it works, and what are the ramifications of going off a specific diet? Why does that happen? Why does that have a bad effect on the body or the effectiveness of the medication?
Now, Chris, don't get off the phone. Dr. Michaels may want to answer your question. Go ahead.
Okay. Good question, and it's confusing for many people. MAOIs, it stands for monoamine oxidase inhibitors. These are older antidepressants that block an enzyme that's involved in degrading or breaking down certain chemicals in our brain. So when you are on an MAOI inhibitor, you end up with more chemicals like norepinephrine or serotonin, the feel-good neurotransmitters.
Okay.
So the problem is, though, if you are eating certain foods like certain cheeses or you're drinking certain alcoholic beverages, your body can't break them down appropriately, and you build up tyramine, and this can lead to high blood pressure and, in severe cases, even a stroke. So you have to avoid certain foods so that you don't get an MAOI response. They're very good antidepressants.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Alcohol is definitely out.
Most forms of alcohol, yes.
Fine. Okay.
And cheese. And prepared meats and other substances that are aged should be avoided. But the best thing to do is go online and look at the MAOI diet, and you will see exactly what to avoid.
Okay. Excellent.
Thanks for
Thank
calling.
You.
Yep. Telephone number is 1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-2551. There is a free phone. You should be on it. Okay, let's go to Susan in Northampton. Okay, Susan, you're on.
Hi. My question is, I'm a person who suffers from bipolar depression, and it's been really hard for me to find effective treatment because it tends, any typical antidepressant that I've tried has generally made me more unstable. I've been doing some reading about Suboxone for treatment-resistant depression, and I spoke to my prescriber about it, and she didn't feel like she had enough information to really, like, know much about that. And what's on the web, like, I don't always, I kind of take with a grain of salt. So I was just wondering if you had any, like, actual, you know, do people do this? Is it really bad thing to do? Is it a good thing to do? I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, it's certainly something that I wouldn't want to, like, obviously it's putting your body into a dependent state on another drug, and that's not a goal, but the depression can be really, really crippling at times.
Okay.
Without treatment options.
Sure. And when people have bipolar, they not only get manic, but they can have these terrible depressions.
I tend to get more depressed. And then when I end up with an antidepressant, I get really, really manic.
Okay. So there have been a few studies looking at Suboxone to treat depression, very tiny studies, and obviously it's what we call off-label. It's not indicated by the FDA.
And right, yeah.
It's mostly looked at unipolar depression, not manic depression. Before going to Suboxone, I would think about a mood stabilizer, and that's something like lithium or Trilec.
I've just started taking a low dose of lithium, and I've been on Seroquel for about 15 years.
Okay. So lithium may help with the depression. And a lot of people think about lithium for mania, but it's actually a medicine that can help with depression, too. So I would do something that is more mainstream like that before going to Suboxone, which has very limited evidence. I wouldn't say it would never work, but it doesn't have a high degree of research that supports using it for depression.
So let me just point
out. Yeah, and it doesn't seem like, from what I've read, that the risks of it kind of outweigh the benefits at this point, because there is little information out there about it. So,
and I like that you talked to your doctor about it. So you should always be under a doctor's care. What I have discovered is you could go on the internet and find any scrap of information to support what you'd like to do. But it's wonderful that you're talking to a physician who knows you and will follow up and can continue to treat you.
Well, that's great. Thank you very much, Susan. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you.
We'll go to Lori in Hoosick Falls. Okay, Lori, you're on. Uh-oh, I think I heard a hang up. Yep. I'm good at that. Okay, let's go to, take the next one, too. Let's go to Laura in where? Where? Laura, you're on.
Hi there. Our local the owners of our local hospital are looking at closing down one of the inpatient floors. And one of the options they're considering for putting in there instead is a short-term inpatient drug rehab center. And the coalition, who our first choice is to keep the inpatient floor as it is, but looking at the different options, are short-term rehab centers successful in the overall plan of drug addiction, or are they not? And I appreciate your help. Thank you.
Stay there.
Sure. It depends on what we mean by short term. If we're talking about 3 or 4 days of detoxification and then the person is discharged, that's not ideal. Mm-hmm. Over 90% of people will relapse after a very brief treatment. And, you know, we've defunded that 28-day program that was the standard for so long. Some of that's coming back, and people need more time to initiate the recovery. And then after those programs, they need a day program or they need an outpatient clinic. So we're talking about a continuum of care. But think about it this way. If you had diabetes and we put you in the hospital for 3 days and then said, okay, your blood sugar's normal, you're out, how successful would you be?
Good point.
You'd have to learn how to eat.
Yeah, you'd have to relearn how to live your life with a chronic disease. It's exactly the same for someone with a substance use disorder.
Interesting. Well, Laura, great series of questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah,
bye.
We'll go to Scott in Albany. Okay, Scott, your turn.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Doctor.
Hi.
Good to speak to you guys. Just a quick question. I was wondering if there's any risk to taking on a daily basis, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it correctly, diphenhydramine as a sleep aid?
I know what you're talking about, I think.
The antihistamine or something?
Diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl. That's... I had to think for a second. I think if you take very high doses, it can impair your driving the next day. This is Benadryl, diphenhydramine. And it's been shown that if you take high doses, the next day you wake up sedated and you will be impaired. So I would just say take the lowest dose possible. Talk to the doctor, even though it's over the counter. You always want to tell your doctor and you want to get feedback because there could be a drug-drug interaction with something else that you're taking. But I think there are preparations of diphenhydramine that are for sleep that some people buy.
And do doctors know enough? I mean, I ask you that as the expert in our area, but do doctors know enough about what to do when somebody presents with addiction?
I think for the longest time, doctors would feel anxiety when someone talked about addiction. They would want to avoid it because it wasn't something they were trained to deal with. And hopefully that's beginning to change. There's also stigma attached to addiction.
You
so
bet.
Many doctors judge their patients and, I don't want to, get out of here.
Yeah.
I don't want you. You're an addict. I mean, I've had patients come to me and say that's what their primary care doctor has said to them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sad. Scott?
Yep, but so there's really no health risks due to taking it daily?
Well, she just told you there was.
Well,
I mean, you don't want to get sedated to the point where you're going to drive off the road.
Oh, no, never anything like that. I take it to be able to fall asleep easier, but I just didn't know if there was any negative effects to taking it daily.
Yeah, too much can be harmful. And again, talk to your primary care doctor just to confirm that for you, it's the wise thing to do.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Scott. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Merle in Kingston. Merle, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hey, hi. I have a question for Dr. Michaels. There's a natural substance, maybe plant-based, not being used in this country, to my knowledge, called ibogaine. And I didn't know if the doctor had any knowledge of it or how it works.
Okay. I do know about ibogaine. It's been around for a long time. It has what I would call a cult following, and it's a hallucinogen with a long-acting effect. So people often will go to Europe to an ibogaine clinic and experience a hallucinatory event that lasts for days while they're on ibogaine. And the idea is when you wake up from your hallucinations, you'll be cured of your heroin addiction. It's not available in this country because it doesn't work. It's a nice idea. And as I said, it has a cult following. But it's a hallucinogen, and it doesn't address the complexities of heroin addiction.
Okay. So even with the purpose of withdrawal, it does not really work.
It's exotic, but it doesn't work.
Okay.
Well,
all right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. Okay. We'll go to Jenny in Queensbury. Jenny, you're on.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Shartok. Hi, Dr. Michaels. Thanks for taking the call. I have a couple of quick questions. Obviously, living in Queensbury, it's such a small community, and we go to these health centers, HHN. And even in the fact that I've been on trazodone for sleep through a psychiatrist and Seroquel to help me sleep, they often, again, they treat you like you're asking for something wacky because of all the heroin problem in the area. But so I'm wondering, what do you do in that case? Because the whole thing is linked. You can't talk to an administrator without it going through, and it's all connected. My other question is, can a primary care prescribe Suboxone? And why is it that we are not using methadone like we used to?
Okay. So Lots of questions. So
I'm sorry.
No,
and
that's
only, and only
good.
2 minutes to answer because we had a break coming up.
Okay,
I'm sorry,
so very quickly.
No, that's all right.
You know, trazodone and Seroquel are medications. They're classically psychiatric medications, and psychiatric illness is real. So if you're experiencing stigma, is it your pharmacy?
I would. It's mostly when I call in to get the medications again. It's like a pain in the tuchus, and I'm a grown woman, and I don't want to be treated as differently, but I'm so much more concerned about the methadone versus Suboxone, and I know we only have a second, so if you want to skip that, I'll deal with the stigma later. But
hold on, go ahead.
But so you have a valid reason to get your medication, and I always tell people, to fight the stigma. Be proud that you're being responsible for an illness and taking medicine that works. If somebody treats you badly, you can complain about them.
Right.
So that's something to think about. As far as Suboxone versus methadone, they are both effective at addressing heroin addiction or opioid pill addiction.
Mm-hmm.
For some people, methadone works better. For other people, Suboxone. The important thing is that we need a variety of treatments. No one treatment works for all people.
Can we get those through a primary care visit in the Adirondacks? I mean, I grew up in Manhattan. Can you actually go through?
If your doctor has training and has what we call an X number. It's a weird saying, but an X number, meaning the DEA will allow him to prescribe or her prescribe Suboxone, yes. But the doctor has to go through specialty training. You can look up doctors in your area to get Suboxone. So you don't have to go to a clinic. And that's part of the appeal of Suboxone.
So how would you do it? Go to Google and just say doctors who are allowed to prescribe Suboxone?
In my area, yeah. And you'll get a whole list.
Well, that's great.
Listen, this is a fabulous show. I thank you, and I bet a million other people do, too.
Thank you, Jenny. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Take care.
Yep. We'll take a very short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, now specializing in Makoplasty partial knee surfacing as an option to total knee replacement for early to mid-stage osteoarthritis. HealthQuest.org/ortho. NBT Bank, offering trust and fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com. Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe and from local artisans with weekly tastings, stocking single malts, bourbons, tequilas, and gins. GrapesandGrainsWine.com. The Montessori School of the Berkshires, dedicated to engaging the natural curiosity of children, toddler through eighth grade, now enrolling for fall 2016, BerkshireMontessori.org. And from the Albany Pinebush Preserve, presenting the Capital Region's National Natural Landmark with an interactive visitor center, guided programs, and 20 miles of trails, albanypinebush.org.
And we are back, thanks to Zachary, our wonderful engineer who knows how to do this. And Dr. Jennifer Michaels is with us. I just want to thank our very good friend, Mr. David Phelps, who's the head, the big boss at the Berkshire Health Systems, and who helps pay for her ability to do this work in the area. Right? Isn't that right?
Yes, and he's been very kind to the Breen Center and is helping us to hopefully open a women's recovery home, halfway house.
Yeah.
So we are very grateful to David Phelps.
We love the guy. Okay, let's go to Cindy on the Thruway. All right, Cindy on the Thruway, you're on.
Hello, and thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about Ibogaine, and I'm glad the doctor has already had a question about it. My daughter has been a tremendous addict. She had suffered for years. We did all therapies, rehabilitation centers. I spent thousands and thousands of dollars. And as a last resort, went to an Ibogaine facility. And I am covered in goosebumps when I think about how well and healthy my daughter is now. This is a hallucinatory drug. It had an impact on her like no other rehabilitation did. And I want you to know this is not a fantasy. This is real.
Okay. Okay, so Cindy, I think you made your point. There are a lot of people behind you. Doctor, you're on.
Well, it's wonderful that it worked for your loved one. Studies have not shown that in general, but there's always, that exception to the rule. So I think
they have an 80% success rate.
Excuse me, we don't know.
Compared to the 20% in rehab.
Well,
that's not what I have learned. I'm very glad your daughter has done well, but I think that there is, as I said, there's a bit of a cult following to this, and it, and I would caution people from traveling out of the country to get a treatment that's not
FDA
approved.
Cindy,
yeah.
Thanks for the insight. Okay, we'll go to Dick in Longmeadow. Dick in Longmeadow, you're on.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, this is kind of a little different. I'm talking about some socially acceptable drugs that I used to see abused because I was in the business for many years. And
You mean you were a pharmacist?
I was a pharmaceutical salesman for 38 years.
Okay, gotcha.
And the drug that I see abused now, and you still see it abused, is Carisperdal. And if you take a couple of Carisperdal with an Ativan, these kids just go flying. And I was just wondering if the doctor could make some comments about that.
Yes. I think it's Soma you're talking about. People
yes.
may be more familiar with that.
Right.
But you're 100% right that there are these medicines that are considered safe, like Ultram, Soma.
Right. Exactly.
And they're not safe. And we're seeing also young people using dextromethorphan.
Yep.
And getting addicted and getting very
yeah.
sick.
Right.
And
right.
And it's under the radar. We're focused on opioids, and Soma's not an opioid.
Yeah,
it's
believe it or not, doctor, I used to see thousands go out of the drugstore.
You used to see
thousands go out of the drugstore?
Literally, they were using, getting prescriptions so frequently that some drugstores had to order 3,000 and 4,000, or 5 bottles of 1,000 of Carisperdal, and how many thousand Ativans. And
yeah.
I'd say to myself, these people are buzzing themselves out because they're using these drugs together. And I know there's no such thing, but it's almost a socially acceptable thing there because they're not harmful, supposedly.
Yes. Yeah, and I don't think it's being included in looking at this epidemic, and they should be.
Dick, yeah, I think so, too.
Dick, very helpful. We thank you so much for spending the time with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll go to Barbara in Amherst. Did I ever tell you that Amherst is one of my favorite places in the whole world? I love Amherst.
Oh.
Go ahead, Barbara.
Nice. Dr. Michael, thanks a lot. I have a family member who had diabetes and fibromyalgia, then developed colorectal cancer. This is just the short version, and had surgery, which fell apart, and so she was basically in the hospital for like 5 months, and finally got out and quite addicted to various painkillers, and it's now off the fentanyl and is half off the oxycodone, but is having a lot of anxiety, so is taking lorazepam and the oxycodone. And my question is, can medical marijuana be an exit drug for opioids? I'd say she isn't necessarily an addictive personality in general. It's been a kind of a long, hard road, and I'm wondering if you think that could be helpful to her in her anxiety, appetite problems, sleep problems, pain. You know, it kind of seems like it might fit. What do you think?
You know, the evidence is not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at evidence for medical marijuana, there are a few areas that, there is evidence, such as pain related to cancer or multiple sclerosis, severe muscle spasms, but we're not seeing other areas where it's supported when we do studies.
Mm-hmm.
So I would ask you to have the doctor treating her get involved. A very slow taper is often effective, and then also addressing her symptoms. The sleep can be addressed, but I at this point wouldn't recommend medical marijuana because the evidence just isn't there.
Mm-hmm. So it may come along, but it's not proven.
Yes, yes, but her doctor should be the one helping her to decide.
Yeah, her doctor's involved.
Good, good. That's the best.
Barbara, thank you for the call. We have so many people behind you that we just want to try to get them in. Thanks a lot. Yeah, bye. We'll go to Carolyn in Poughkeepsie. Carolyn,
you're on. Yes, hi. Thank you for having this program. As the nation goes forward trying to solve this epidemic. I'd love to hear the doctor's comments regarding patient care coordination. Our family has been visited by this awful disease, which it is truly a disease, and our family's been afflicted by other more common diseases, and then you have a patient care coordinator. If you have pancreatic cancer, you have somebody coordinating all the different arms of care. But what our journey has been, it just has lacked a go-to central coordinator who can keep tabs on this patient as he moves through this this disease.
Well, now,
and
Carolyn,
it's up to the family.
Carolyn, I don't want to interrupt, but I do want to let everybody have a say here if we can. We really get it, and I certainly agree with you. Even, you know, as a 74-year-old guy and your primary sends you to four different people for different things that may be wrong with you, you know, the concept of coordination is terribly important. And I think you're right. Doctor?
I think we're all on the same page. And leaving it up to the person suffering from addiction is the worst way to go.
Yeah, they can't manage their own
care. Exactly.
Yeah. And a patient care coordinator can go to your home, can make the phone calls, can drive you to the appointments. We do that for other diseases, and we're not doing it for substance use disorders, and we should be.
Carolyn, thank
you.
Can
I just quickly ask, is this being addressed as we move forward with funding and looking at this in the way, do you see where this is being addressed by anybody who's making decisions?
There's a little bit of it happening with some grant money. There's not enough of it, though. But
okay.
I think that your voice is very important. I think advocacy, calling your legislators, is so important so that we get what we deserve for these people who, you know, this is a treatable disease. And yet we have an epidemic of people dying.
Mm. Right.
Carolyn, thank
you. Okay, thank you. Here.
Bye. We'll go to Lori in Hoosick Falls. Okay, Lori, you're on. Go.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Perfectly.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you, Dr. Michaels, for all the work that you do.
This is
a question about hope. I have a friend, a wonderful person, who is a decades-long crack cocaine addict. And has tried everything and continues to try to heal himself through various methods. And it's like Groundhog Day.
Mm.
And I don't know, you know, at what point you just say this is hopeless, or if after, you know, 30 years plus you can have any kind of hope and if there's any new breakthroughs with regards to this terrible addiction.
Well, you know, I was just in my office about an hour ago talking to a patient who said, you know, the Suboxone works great. I don't want to use heroin, but I'm still using cocaine. And isn't there a Suboxone for cocaine? And sadly, there is no medicine that will help with cocaine cravings the way we have methadone or Suboxone. I never give up hope. I always say to my patients that what you're doing, the treatment you're getting is inadequate if you keep using and you need more treatment. You need a higher level of care. And for some people, that means a residential program. It may be that they get sectioned to a program involuntarily. But has your friend tried residential programs longer term, like 3 months or 6 months?
I don't think more than, you know, maybe a month and a half. I'm not 100% sure about that.
Okay, so that's something to consider. And I never give up hope, but I think it's also important to get your own support. And that could be at an Al-Anon meeting or a Learn to Cope meeting. These are for people who have a loved one who's using.
No, doctor, isn't there a point at which we used to learn this back when I was doing my NIMH fellowship, that it burns, that addictions can burn out at a certain age. Is that an old man's tale? I say old man's because I don't want to go into the feminist, you know, say old lady. That's
old person's tale.
Yeah, right.
I think that what we see is people can die from addiction.
Sure.
They can go to jail. They can get recovery. Usually at some point something shifts because it's hard to sustain this disease.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Lori, thank you for your great call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Right. We'll go to Gail in Chatham. Gail in Chatham, you're on.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I take... I have a problem with calling the opiate prescription drug avenue as the cause of our current drug crisis. I'm a parent of a mentally ill addict. I go to Narnon groups with parents like me who have kids of like ages, and none of them were started using OxyContin or the other prescription opiates. And I think this has become a red herring. I don't deny that that's a start to for some people to heroin use or further illegal opiate use. But I think there's a culture among the young people of using drugs that didn't exist before, and we have this whole other avenue of young people experimenting with drugs and becoming addicted that isn't adequately being addressed.
Okay, now, Gail, I have to say this because we only have a couple of seconds left in the show. Jen, would you like to answer this?
Just that it's not a homogeneous group. So in my practice, I see most people using opioid pills. You know, 20 years ago, 15 years ago, it was opioid pills. And now we're seeing people initiating with heroin. So it's evolved over time, but it started with opioid pills in 1995. And now as we cut back pills, more people are using heroin. They're graduating to heroin or they're initiating with heroin.
It's cheaper.
Yeah, cheaper than a pill.
Yeah.
Cheaper than an ice cream sundae.
My son started using at age 20, and he went away to college and started using with, and all his friends were using. And it was really sort of a peer group, you know,
okay.
Adventure.
Okay, but Gail, it's important information, but is there a question here? Because I want to...
I want to know, is there any... I recognize that Massachusetts governors making an effort to sort of control the prescription end of this, but what's being done to control the kids who are just starting out on heroin, just for the hell of it?
So people can access treatment whether they're using pills or they're using heroin. And I agree with you that we're seeing it evolve as we cut back with the availability of pills. Narcan will work whether someone is using heroin or using pills. Suboxone, methadone works for both. Huh. And we're going to see, and we are seeing more heroin use as pills become less available.
Very interesting. Gail, I'm so sorry. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go very quickly to Melissa from Poughkeepsie. Melissa, we need your question or statement real fast.
Okay, back in just a few months ago in Thanksgiving, my sister-in-law was medevaced to Strong with no brain activity on a respirator due to overdose of ecstasy. She said it was 60 tabs, I guess. I don't know how it's taken. She refuses. She since then came out of it. And is now without her children, but walking around and going to work. And my two questions are, is there significant brain damage from what you might know of this drug? I know it's a bunch of chemicals that are mixed together. I don't know exactly what they are. And two, is there addiction to hallucinogenic drugs? I know that they also would do ketamine and things like that. I'll wait for your answer. Thank you.
Thank you. Ecstasy can damage your serotonin system, so people are more likely to be depressed after extensive use, and so your loved one may need treatment for depression. And
yep.
Can people get addicted to hallucinogens? Yes, they can. Not physiologically the way they do to heroin, per se, but they crave it. They use more than they should. It interferes and impairs their life. Yes.
Right.
Okay. Melissa, thank you. Okay. And nope, we don't have any more time. We are just out of time. My apologies to those people left on the line, anybody who may have written in. I want to thank Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for being with us today. I know how busy you are, Jen, and you have been such an inspiration to all of us. Support for Medical Monday comes from Protex Gloves, helping to provide relief from chronic skin and hand conditions, including peripheral neuropathy, scleroderma, and Raynaud's, and eczema, UVA, and UVB sun protection. ProtexGloves.com. Thanks to our engineer, the incredible Zach Malloy, to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones. Our producers, Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/VoxPop. Stay tuned now for a news update.